Well, it's been a week now since Tropical Cyclone Debbie made landfall at Airlie Beach in Queensland before making her way down the coast to northern New South Wales, leaving a trail of devastation. And of course, this continues to cause havoc. Floodwaters are rising, as we just heard in the news, in the central Queensland town of Rockhampton, still ahead of an expected river metre peak of a 9 metre peak tomorrow. The human toll of the disaster flood is also rising, with the deaths of a mother and her two children when her car she was driving skidded off a muddy road into the swollen Tweed River. The damage bill from the cyclone and the ensuing floods is expected to be in the billions of dollars, in lives lost, property and infrastructure destroyed, and businesses and farmers deluged. Yet after these major natural disasters, the same questions are always asked. Could more have been done to mitigate against these disasters? Are insurers too brutal, too heartless in their treatment of customers to flood-prone areas? And then there's the elephant in the room, climate change, with scientists warning that events like cyclones and floods will become more frequent and more intense as the climate warms. Are there lessons we can learn from this disaster? Surely the answer is yes. I'm joined by a panel of experts this morning. Carl Mallon is the Director of Climate Risk, a consultancy providing extreme weather and climate change risk analytics to large utilities and state government entities. Also joined by Rob Whelan, the CEO of the Insurance Council of Australia. And on the line from Perth, bright and early, is Andrew Gissing from Macquarie University's Risk Frontiers. He's an emergency and risk management expert. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Fran.
Rob, Carl, good morning. Welcome to breakfast.
Good morning.
Andrew, let's start with you on the phone there. You've just flown to Perth from Lismore. What was your observation about this flood event that continues to engulf northern New South Wales in terms of intensity and havoc wreaked? How does it rate?
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely one of the biggest floods I've seen in my time, especially in terms of the level of community damage to the CBD and also to the residences. I do say though that I think that if the floodwaters had probably been another foot higher in Lismore, that the damage would have been so much more significant, and possibly the peril that people faced, especially when so many people didn't evacuate and sheltered in their own homes, a lot more water would have been through people's homes, and I would have really feared for the people that had sheltered there.
Well, it was already over the flood levy, controversially. It breached the levy, and on Monday, the mayor of the Lismore area, Isaac Smith, explained why the levy wasn't built to the 1974 flood level. Let's have a listen.
We have to understand that the levy has been in place for 12 years. It has kept out four minor floods. So it's already saved tens of millions of dollars and definitely paid its value back. But the problem with engineering on the river is that to go up even another metre or two required substantially more money. And look, to be honest, no one wants to live next to a Berlin Wall. That'd be like going down to Sydney and sort of walling up the harbour, or going to Melbourne and saying the Yarra is just not worth looking at.
That's the Mayor of Lismore. What do you think, Andrew? Was that a miscalculation by the council?
No, not at all. I think the levy has worked well. It's kept out the 2005-2009 event, and the council has been very proactive in the business district there with the SES to educate people about the limitations of the levy, because there's an element of which this is a partnership between government and the community, that government in that sense has invested in mitigation to the extent that it's cost effective and it's practical. The community is also responsible for managing their own individual risks. One thing that we've picked up in our research most recently in Lismore, however, has been that the community can be lulled into a false sense of security as a consequence of mitigation being built. So there's possibilities that during the flood that people put too much emphasis on the protection of the levee, being lulled into a false sense of security, and maybe not preparing quick enough and being caught off guard.
It's kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, isn't it? Rob, let me ask you something before we go any further and talk about the criticisms of the insurance industry, which always come at this time. Mitigation, Andrew mentioned there, we'll talk about it some more. Mitigation is also one of the things that the insurance industry talks about. What do we mean when we talk about mitigation? What is it that you would like governments to do?
Well, basically, it's about spending more money before an event rather than spending the money after an event. About 70% or more, 90% even, of government funding for disaster goes post-event. And we're arguing that a lot more should be spent early amongst areas that are high risk And we do know where those areas are because they continuously are affected by major disasters.
So to do what, though? I think a lot of us hear these words, adaptation, mitigation, don't really know what we're talking about. Build a levee, is that it, or what?
No, it's a broader set of issues that need to be undertaken. Firstly, you need to think about the sort of building stock that's actually in harm's way in these places and what can be done about those. In some cases, it is about building walls and levees and better drainage and things of that nature. Not particularly sexy things. I hear what they're saying in Lismore, but at the end of the day, that's a massive amount of damage that's going to cost a lot of money and affect people for a very long period of time. And yes, living with a wall is not great, but at the end of the day, it's better than having your home destroyed, your business destroyed, and perhaps the loss of life as well. So we hear that, but we also think that if you're going to have mitigation, then you need to have effective mitigation, and that goes to understanding what the true risk is. And that's what insurance companies have to do. They have to rate to the risk that they're actually exposed to.
Carl, that's what you do, is advise on risk and calculate risk, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're doing this every day with utilities. For example, during these events, we were in very close contact with one of our clients who provide, essential water into Brisbane, and we were, tracking how our analytics were going against some of the assets. I guess the bit that I wonder about here is in the government and in the utilities sector, the kind of analysis to look at the risk, the kind of calculations that Rob's talking about are done every day, and climate change is factored in to the decisions about those assets and what to do with them, how to adapt them and protect them. And the thing that I think is really lacking here is that the everyday mum and dad do not have access to that, and they don't have the ability to make a decision based on insurability. So they get a surprise when they get a multi-$1,000 insurance bill, but they get it after they bought the house, and they don't get to essentially start to make, I guess, decisions about where they live or their home before the fact. They only discover afterwards.
So what are you suggesting? We have some kind of star rating for houses banked on based on insurability or risk? Do we have the capacity to calculate that risk and do that?
Look, we have the capacity to do it. I think there's a couple of issues. One is about the cost. And the other one is around the access to data. I mean, in this situation, I'm thinking, how do we get that through? We have the analytics to be able to do it. People like Rob have the data. I mean, I'm actually thinking
it
right now.
It would shred house prices, wouldn't it, in some areas?
Yes, it would. Yes, because they're at risk, and it happens frequently. So that's the issue that we have to get across, is getting people to understand what their actual risk is. And yes, there's more that can be done by the industry and by government to do that more effectively. And we're getting better at getting the information, because it is about being able to collect that information, which often resides with local councils. So it's getting that information from the local councils, making sure it's up to date, because quite often it's not, and then being able to translate that into something that people can attend to.
You're listening to RM Breakfast, our Friday panel, Andrew Gissing, Carl Mallon, Rob Whelan. Andrew, just sense from what we're talking about, though, it all comes back to the home buyer and their responsibility or where they're living. Is that the right way to be looking at this? Is that fair? I mean, we've got Rob here from the Insurance Council. Do you have a message for the Insurance Council and the insurers and the role they play?
Yes, I do.
Hang on, let me go to Andrew and then I'll come back to you, Rob. Andrew?
Well, just reflecting on the previous the panel answers, I fully support those, that a lot of this is about risk disclosure. And our organisation, Risk Frontiers, if government said we want to do this tomorrow, we've got products out there that we could launch into the market with some capital support from government to provide householders with much improved information about their natural disaster risk.
Andrew?
Just be able to give household ratings about natural disaster risks. And some of those are already available out there through property websites, etc. I think it's a mixture of both. So there needs to be that government disclosure risk information. The Productivity Commission picked that up in their report for government in 2014, that needed to be improved. But there also needs to be an overall understanding by new purchases of property, but also the community in general, about needing to understand their natural hazard risks. But it needs to be available to them. Like I see examples examples quite often where, for example, somebody might want to search their flood risk, but then they have to pay hundreds of dollars to a local council to get a proper report about their flood risk. So we need to be removing those barriers for people to be able to understand their risk. Could insurance do more? I think, as the Productivity Commission report said as well, that the insurance market is generally working fairly well. I don't think, especially when people live in such risky areas, that it should be an expectation that they can get cheap insurance. That actually having a market signal in there is actually good for mitigation, in that where insurance prices are possibly are quite high, that's actually a signal to government and the community to say, actually, we really need to be investing in mitigation here so we can bring those prices back down.
Rob, I imagine you'd agree with that scenario, and yet it is your industry that crops a lot of criticism at times like this and is portrayed too often as a bit sneaky and a bit cruel and a bit heartless.
Yeah.
What do you understand that response? And are you trying to change, is your industry trying to change anything at all in the, beg your pardon, in the products it covers or the way it offers people coverage? Because we've heard so many stories already just in this flood alone, people couldn't afford flood insurance. Sure. What should they do? Just pack up and leave the house?
No, the industry is getting better and better at being able to understand the risk profiles of individuals and be able to price it more effectively. Price signals are important because it does give people a clear understanding of what their risk is versus somebody else in the street or somebody else in the community. But at the end of the day, we need to do more than that. We need to be able to provide them with information of what they do about it and how they can actually reduce that risk, because by reducing the
risk...
And
are they doing that? Insurance?
In some cases they are. A good example is Roma in Queensland, where that was a city that, again, was highly prone to flood. It flooded, I think, about five times in the last 7 years. And they built a levee, finally. And the insurance companies were able to reduce the premiums to those people in around 70 to 90% in some cases. So it is a risk and rate return equation that we have to understand. And what we would rather do is start being able to mitigate the risk down so we can bring the prices down.
Can you build a levee high enough to mitigate for climate change, essentially? That's what we're talking here, isn't it?
You can build a certain mitigation up to a certain level. You can't stop everything, because these storms, and it's been the case since about 2006, we've seen a real pattern in the growth of some of these events as quite large and frequent. You can do some, and rather than just letting them hit you, but being able to accommodate some of the size of these storms, like Yasi, for example, that's a massive storm. So.
Carl, you're chomping at the bit to get in?
Yeah, look, you know, I think we're in furious agreement about the price signal and that you can't paper over this, but I think the insurance companies have been sneaky, which is that, you know, some of them are getting out of these areas. Like if you go on to, I just checked it today, Allianz's website, you'll find that in far north Queensland, they won't give cover.
Mm.
Yeah, so the insurance, some of these companies are backing slowly out. And I've got a challenge for you, Rob. Mm. You've got flood data that you've collected from councils, okay? Digital data. You give me that data and I'll put a free service up for mums and dads and homeowners that will tell them what their insurability will be over the term of their mortgage. So including climate change, and that will tell them whether their house is safe and whether the value will deteriorate because of climate change. That's what we need in the market. We need people able to see what they're looking at. And if there's a problem, at least they can then do something about it. They can engage with their bank or their council about fixing these up. But let's get that signal through to the mums and dads, to the homeowners, to the home buyers, and then let's start to get this on the table and do something about
it.
So
a completely open buyer beware situation is what you'd be creating there? Rob, do you see a problem with that?
That's entirely possible, and I'm sure we can do a deal at some stage.
As I say, it's the real estate agents and the local councils and some of the state governments who'd be a bit worried about the impact of that, because it would mean a lot of houses being basically the bottom dropping out of that housing market, wouldn't it?
Look.
Mortgages being worthless suddenly.
Look, that's why we're not doing it, because everyone's afraid of the step. So what's happening is we're just putting this problem off and off and off. At some point, we've just got to bite the bullet and get on with it. Otherwise, people are in Lismore and places like that get the shock, and people like Rob have to deal with the fallout. It's better we face up to this, and as I think Rob will back me up on this, every dollar you spend before an event saves you hundreds when the event comes. So it's way cheaper to deal with this before we're facing the the aftermath.
Just before I finish there with you, Carl, you have said before, I've noticed, that you think that the insurance industry could be offering more sophisticated products to help buyers out. So instead of leaving people completely uninsurable, what do you mean?
Look, the insurers are the messengers here. They are not the cause of the problem. But we've got problems, for example, on the coastal areas where insurers do not provide, for example, coastal inundation cover. So you can go and get a mortgage with a high street bank. The bank will sell you a branded product, but in there will be a small print which will say you're not covered for actions of the sea. Okay? As sea levels rise, as our communities become more at risk, we need more products. So we need insurers stepping up with more products, not retreating.
Andrew, do you have a view on the role of the insurers? And in particular, I mean, there seems to be the end point we're heading towards here, is that we just have to bite this bullet and accept there's some places we are living in, we are currently building in, we are building new developments in, that we shouldn't be. Is that the simple truth of it? How do we stop this?
Yeah, well, you know, there's the issue of the risk that's present there now in the community, you know, in terms of cyclones, fires, floods, the whole lot. And then there's the future risk in terms of, you know, where do we actually develop, where do we place our infrastructure. So, you know, a bit of a roadmap forward, I think, in terms of where people can go with this, is that a lot of it revolves around having a good understanding about the risks in local communities such that risk can be prioritised and that the cost-effectiveness of mitigation can be well understood. One of the critical issues at the moment is that a lot of the investment, we're not 100% sure that it's going to the most cost-effective and highest risk investment priorities, because simply we need to get better at being able to compare different risks together, and we need a better understanding overall of the effectiveness of different mitigation types. Some have been very effective. You look at the building codes in Northern Australia and look at the level of damage that have occurred to buildings after 1985, when those building codes came in, and it's essentially prevented wide-scale destruction in northern Australia this time as a consequence of Cyclone Debbie,
sure,
as opposed to, you know, a tropical cyclone, a Tracy type model.
Okay.
When we look at future risk, it's really about risk-based land use planning. So, and this also ties in with insurance, that, you know, if you're going to go and develop in an area, for example, which is well beneath the 1 in 100 year flood line, well, yes, you should expect to pay a lot of money for flood insurance, because you're actually developing in a really bad area to develop. And this is about sending a risk-based signal to developers to say, actually, it's not a great place to develop here. How about you develop over here, which is going to be far, far safer and also far more sustainable for your community going forward.
Okay, we're pretty much out of time, but meanwhile, I'm pretty sure the next disaster will happen and we'll all be focused again. I mean, these costs are enormous. We are talking billions of dollars every time one of these disasters occurs. And it seems to me the focus is all very much on disaster response and the dollars of relief money rather than these questions we're talking about here. Very briefly, Rob, a final word from you.
Look, it is about being able to get effective partnerships between the industry and all levels of government, because the only way you're going to solve this problem, and particularly with climate change factored in as well, is to have an effective, productive partnership to deal with this.
And factoring climate change might be the first hurdle. Carl Mallon, Rob Whelan, and Andrew Gissing, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl Mallon is the Director of Climate Risk, a consultancy providing extreme weather and climate change risk analytics to large utilities and state government entities. And after his offer today, maybe a database for homeowners to check the value of a house they're thinking of buying in terms of its rating of risk and resilience. Rob Whelan is the CEO of the Insurance Council of Australia, and Andrew Gissing from Macquarie University's Risk Frontiers, an emergency and risk management expert. You're listening to Breakfast. It's 4 minutes to 8.